Welcome back, everybody. It's Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Now, to me, one of the lifeblood of our democracy are reporters and investigative reporters, people who spend their time going through hundreds and thousands of pages of documents and interviewing people and figuring out what is really the story that we're not getting. One of those reporters I've always felt is Mark Reuter, who is senior editor and reporter for the Baltimore Brew, who's been covering the developments like Port Covington, Harbor East, and more, and is still working on them and joins us for this first part of our program to talk about the work he's doing now and what he's done before around the issues of TIFFs. And Mark, good to have you with us in the studio. Welcome.
Delighted to be here.
And you all can join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. By email, you can also tweet at Mark Steiner. Get on our Facebook pages. If you do have questions, you hear them, jump out early, because after we talk to Mark, we meet Winfield Parker, so you want to get your calls in early if you want to join us. 410-319-8888. So, Mark, let's just take a quick step backwards. This whole question of TIFFs and the taxes deferred that we're seeing now, Port Covington wants $500 million. We saw what happened to Harbor East. But just very quickly, give us a historical perspective, because this was not always the case in Baltimore.
Right. Well, TIFFs is a fairly new phenomenon nationwide. It dates back to the 1950s in California. Interestingly enough, California, which pioneered TIFFs, and I will explain them in one second, has stopped using TIFFs. They no longer use it because it drained so much money out of the tax base when California was facing its financial problems a few years ago. What TIFFs are is they are a public subsidy. They are designated as a public subsidy. They are not technically a tax subsidy. What they are is the floating of bonds in which the future property tax revenues of a development project, which causes enhancements to the value, like when you build an extension to your house, those property tax assessments don't go back to the city or the county. You don't pay them in July, as you and I do with our property, but it goes into a special fund, and that fund pays for the improvements that you're making. So what it does is it defers property taxes, and it means that the city's general fund is deprived of those taxes for a certain period of time. TIFFs were approved by the General Assembly in Maryland in the 1980s, early 80s, so 35 years ago. Baltimore City lobbied for and got an exemption from that. They did not want TIFFs in Baltimore City.
When Schaefer was mayor.
Schaefer was mayor, and he and his staff, which we know like development, love development, were very involved in the Inner Harbor at that moment, thought that TIFFs were a bad idea. TIFFs are supposed to be used under the legislation to provide underwriting to developers in deprived, underserved neighborhoods. It was set up as a anti-poverty tool for cities to help get financing in places like West Baltimore. But even with that, Schaefer thought that it was a bad idea, because the traditional way a city works is that it floats what's called general obligation bonds to build infrastructure. And those are usually very low-cost, very efficient system. It has very low overhead and other costs. A TIFF is also a bond, but because the city is somewhat indirectly removed from the TIFF, and because it involves, instead of just money that you now have, but something that you think will happen in 10 or 20 years, it's much more speculative. It's in effect a junk bond. Therefore, the interest is much higher. The estimate is that a TIFF bond costs the city in deferred taxes 50% more than if it just went straight ahead, issued bonds, and built the infrastructure in the traditional manner.
And those were done by things you call go bonds, right?
Go bonds is what you see that the voters have to approve every election year. There's go bonds for the museums,
right,
for roadways, sidewalks, etc.
And those interest rates are lower.
Much, much lower.
Much lower. And the other piece, now, Hank, we're going to get right to your call, but I just want to set this up. So the other piece was the politics of this. After the year 2000, then a political powerhouse, father of Stephen Rawlings Blake, Pete Rawlings, who was head of the Appropriations Committee in the House in Annapolis, helped engineer laws that took that out of the citizens' hands. They no longer had to vote on whether the city could do this.
Two things happened, beginning at the end of the Schmoke regime and very much so at the beginning of the O'Malley administration, the city started wanting TIFs. At the same time, Pete Rawlings was engineering TIFs, making it much easier for TIFs to be an approval process which would not have the problem of having to go before voters in the general election. So right now in Port Covington, while this November we will have go bonds that will be as little as $500,000 that the voters have to approve or not, and they almost always approve it, but still the voters have a say. Here's $535 million that is totally off the board as long as the city council approves it, which, of course, the mayor has great clout. It becomes law. This was engineered by Rawlings and seized upon largely by O'Malley and has since gotten larger and larger. And the other thing I'd like to point out for listeners is that the first TIFs that O'Malley started were for Mondawmin Mall, for Belvedere Square. They were for some of the mills converted in Jones Falls Valley. These were very small. They were a few million dollars. It was only when Pat Turner, who was, as you know, very involved in the corruption trial of Sheila Dixon, when he proposed this lavish TIF of over $150 million, that the game changed. And since then, as Schaefer feared, if you give a TIF to one developer, the next developer, his lawyers, his political benefactors, et cetera, is said, me too.
So before we go into where we are now, where we think we're going, and we're going to try to get Mark back here in the next week or two and to really kind of develop this in a longer program to really throw lay this out for all of you, because we really need to understand what's going on, because we're going to be confronted by this in the next administration as well. 410-319-8888 is the number here as we talk with Baltimore Brewery Senior Editor Mark Reuter. And Hank, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Roy. Good morning, Mr. Stein.
Good morning, Hank.
What I want to know is, why is it that the public can't vote on these TIFs that we get, that we're giving away, right? If we're giving away all of this money and tax money, right, why aren't we allowed to vote on who can get and how much they can get, as opposed to holding the city council hostage, right? Because they're already lined up with everybody. They're going to do what they're pretty much told to do. Right. And then, too, right, for all of that development for being a millionaire of Under Armour, right, why do we have to give him $500 million? I can see if it was like $100 million. Like, we're giving him $500 million, right, and we get nothing for it. I don't see him saying, well, look, for that $500 million, I'm going to go put air conditioning in all of Baltimore City schools so you don't have to worry about the governor's mandate. Why can't hold his feet to the fire like they hold our feet to the fire? That's what I want to know.
Well, Hank, you raised, you know, really good questions. The story that we wrote in The Brew a couple months ago describes in detail the history that of the maneuverings in Annapolis that were very consciously designed to remove public voting from these TIFs. The city and its allies in the state were worried, ostensibly because they thought bringing it before the voters every 4 years would take too long and that they wanted to act fast on some of these developments. But the real reason and the key reason was that they knew that there might be resistance. So right now, the only approval is the city council, and once they give the go-ahead. The second point people have raised over and over, and it's sort of the irony in my response to the questions of why isn't the billionaire, in this case Plank, putting out some of the money, is my question is, how did he get to be a billionaire in the first place? Case of Under Armour, you know, the manufacturing's overseas, et cetera, et cetera. He's out to make money very explicitly. And the application that that he's produced and that the Brew has been looking at carefully page after page shows that. Basically, he's putting very little skin in the game. The city will underwrite the costs of taking very cheap industrial land he bought. It was cheap because it was industrial land. They will fix it up, put blocks, parks, sewers, other fancy amenities, even a light rail system, which is nowhere else found in a so-called circulator in Baltimore, all this fancy stuff. And then Plank will sell off the property to other developers. The slogan of his company, Sagamore Developments, is "We will build it together." The application shows that he will take government money to develop it and then will sell it.
So, and taking that a step further here, one of the things I think is important to kind of explore a bit in the time that we have, I have a question here as well by email, what people say they're asking for and what they're really asking for, and what people say they're asking for and what it really costs in the end.
Right, right.
And you use Harbor East in our conversations. Harbor Point.
That's what we've been looking at, and in fact, we plan to have a story today in the Brew. Simultaneously to Port Covington asking for this over $500 million in TIFs is the example of what is the previous example of a big TIF, and that's Harbor Point, which 3 years ago won approval from the City Council for a little over $100 million in TIF. Here's what's going on here and what we've developed. That TIF, now in its third year, is facing substantial, actually, in the words of a presidential candidate, massive and huge cost overruns. We're going to be writing about that the TIF is already $25 million in the hole, in effect. We found this information out because it was alluded to in an obscure group in the city government called the Board of Finance, but the city has for the last month refused to give us the documentation that was presented to this committee that shows that there are substantial cost overruns at Harbor Point. And what will happen is that the city said at a closed meeting that they are expecting down the line that these cost overruns will be paid out of the general fund. So the argument that TIFs never cost taxpayers any money, that's an argument that the proponents make, is and that's a theoretical argument, is being defied by the reality now facing the city that it's $25 million in the hole at Harbor Point, and that is counting and will almost invariably go up.
So these are really critical pieces, and that's why in the coming weeks I want to get Mark Roeder back in here to really explore the depth of that and what this means, because we really are just beginning to understand the tip of this. Bruce asked a question here. Why are we not talking about the BDC and how horrible they are? So the BDC, the Baltimore Development Corporation,
right. Bruce, that's a great question, and that's part of the whole system that has developed in Baltimore that is driving these TIFs. The Baltimore Development Corporation, again, didn't exist 20 years ago. It is supposed to develop the city as a whole, but it has been involved in what has to be developer capture or captivity ever since it was really formed. It sees its mandate as developing basically waterfront properties, and it typically closes its meetings, and we've written about that a lot. In the last month, we and the Baltimore Business Journal and The Sun filed a formal complaint with the Open Meetings Compliance Board, state board, and they ruled in our favor. That doesn't mean anything because it doesn't mean that any of the actions they took, such as the unanimous approval of the Port Covington TIF, will be rescinded. But it does mean, which I'll be writing about later today, that some of the minutes of these closed, in effect, secret meetings, closed to the press and public, have now been published on their website. And those talk about the cost overruns at Harbor Point. And again, it makes you wonder how well that group, whether it is protecting or looking at the public's interest or is basically a lapdog for developers.
And they've also kind of refused, as you just said, to show you certain reports that have come out now because they're saying these are – what's the word used? They are
– The finance – the city government has contrasted slightly to the BDC, which is semi-public agency, claims that these documents that we will be publishing parts of today are working documents. Hence, they have refused over a three-week period to supply them. These documents were actually – given out to members of the finance board, and then the members surrendered this information. We believe, and that's why we're going to publish it to the public, that this is very important information that the biggest TIF the city has approved and now is 3 years in operation is way different than what was being told the public 3 years ago.
So I have another question, but let me read this email that came in from Deborah. I'm so happy you're covering the Port Covington debacle this morning. I had recently read that Under Armour pays Yale University $16.5 million over the next 10 years for the right to outfit Yale's athletic teams from Bloomberg Business. How is it possible that a billionaire who is able to pay this amount of money to a client, a very wealthy client, I might add, basically to do business with them, expects us, a very challenged city, to foot the bill for this quote-unquote new campus? We know how this is going to turn out. Just look at all the money Baltimore schools have received from the casino that was used to grease those wheels. So, and in responding to this email, the question of TIFs and the money being given affects our schools in other ways. It affects how much money our schools do not get. But I'm going to get to that as well. But talk to what Deborah was asking.
Well, you know, what she's saying, I think, can be very definitely verified by the facts that are being uncovered and by a public that, you know, and readers, for example, at The Brew, who are very sharp on this. One issue that has been raised is that the city is losing public city subsidies because, again, a TIF is a subsidy, and it is only fair when the state has aid formulas to include those property taxes, even though the city has chosen to divert them to TIF bonds for the developer instead of placing them in the general fund. This argument that the state formula is somehow unfair to Baltimore is really ridiculous. They changed it this year strictly because of politics. What is really important to know is that Port Covington is right now and will for the 30 years it's being proposed to be developed, 25 to 30 years, will be competing and getting many of the very limited resources that the city has. For example, the state, with the city's approval, wants a federal grant to improve the Howard Street Tunnel for the port to get these double-stack trains through the city of Baltimore, thereby producing economic benefits to the port and to the city as a whole. Guess what? That grant program is also coming under challenge or is competing with the new proposal by Sagamore for over $200 million in federal money for new ramps off of I-95 to service Port Covington. And we're going to find that over and over, that money. And we found that at Harbor Point, where the developer first was asked to build the bridge to its project, the bridge at what's called Central Avenue Bridge. That was then changed at the developer's request to the city paying for it. And the city, around 3 years ago, diverted its five-year federal funding of bridges for Hartford Road, bridges for Edmondson Avenue. Those were deferred in order to place this Central Avenue Bridge at the top of the list. And so that's another cost in competition with other projects for the rest of the city.
I mean, this is to me one of the critical points. Which is that it's because we are made to think that TIFs and pilots, when they are given out to developers for their properties, does not and will not affect the money the city can invest in infrastructure for the rest of the city and the citizens. You just laid out a couple of examples. And one of the ones you laid out, the very first one, is very critical, it seems to me, because the people argue about the tunnel for lots of reasons. But let's say, for example, the tunnel allows double-stack trains to get to the port and changes the nature of the port, puts more business in the port. That could actually create jobs for the very people in the city who need them in the west side and east side neighborhoods that are struggling to survive, that could actually get jobs at the port and on the railroad to make a living and create a decent wage in families. I mean, this is more critical than just the dollars and cents. It's how it literally is going to affect the lives of the people of the city.
Right. I mean, this is just a huge project. And think of it. 6 months ago, no one ever even thought about Port Covington. It was not on anyone's radar. It was, in fact, it's been characterized as a wasteland. Actually, it's not. It has a number of facilities, the Sun Papers printing plant, Schuster Concrete. It has several hundred jobs there, and once had one of the biggest rail yards in the country. And that's a sad story that actually goes back into the bad decisions that Baltimore's decision makers have made when you go back into history. Port Covington was once a dump, a city dump. The Western Maryland Railroad made it into its biggest international port. It was one of the major facilities in the Port of Baltimore from the 19-teens until the 1970s. In the 1970s, the Western Maryland, railroad competitive, it had always had shares of its stock owned by the B&O, or CXS then. And there was a proposal by Norfolk Southern to, and stick with me on this, it's kind of interesting, to buy the Western Maryland. And as part of that, because it would have a route, a new route for a new port, Norfolk Southern basically is in Norfolk, it would have enhanced, built up, improved Port Covington and the Western Maryland enormously. As a response, CXS's chairman, a man called John Snow, later Treasury Secretary of some controversy, came to the Maryland delegation and congressional delegation and promised the world to them he would make, CXS would make all these improvements. They blocked the Norfolk Southern merger or purchase of the Western Maryland. Immediately, CXS dismantled the Western Maryland, closed up Port Covington, and we were left with this huge facility that today would be enormously valuable for, guess what? That line to Port Covington goes through no tunnels. The double stacks that are now such a problem would have been, with very minor improvements, could have gone direct to Port Covington. It also is in Baltimore City's boundaries. It is not like the proposed new uses of Sparrows Point, Dundalk Marine Terminal that basically benefit Baltimore County. So it's really sad that that happened. Now, when the city was faced with CXS having all this land that was built for a rail yard, not for development, didn't have many roads, the city, back in the Schmoke period, decided that this was going to be a new urban development. I think it was a very poor decision on their part. And there was some controversy. The port really talked about that it would love this land too. It's right next to the cruise center it was developing. So what we have is a history of around the last 30 or 40 years where there was an industrial facility that in retrospect would right now be a key economic driver in Baltimore. It all fell apart. The city's plans for a stadium, Orioles Park down there, Struver's plans for a big waterfront community all fell apart. And 3 years ago, Under Armour's CEO, Mr. Plank, acting as a private investor, began gobbling up all this land at dirt cheap prices. That's why he needs the TIF, because the land he got doesn't have roads and sewers for what he wants to do. But he bought the land cheap, is getting the city to support this TIF with this. I think illusion, because it hasn't been shown in any of the documents that, well, you won't make any money now, you won't make any money in 10 or 20 years, but in 2050, when we're all, of course, going to be happy and somewhere other than in this life, it will start making tremendous amounts of money. But as I said, the application shows that Planck's company does not plan to stay at Port Covington or the land. They plan to supervise the city's funding of the development and then sell it off to other developers.
So we do have to get this next segment, but let me get this quick call in here, a very quick answer. But we had turned to our friend Winfield Parker, who's standing by at 410-319-8888. Barry, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Bart. Really quick question. Is the Port Covington deal a done deal yet? And if it's not, what engagement can the community do to kind of guide it and direct it?
That's a really good question for listeners. It is considered a done deal in the corridors of City Hall, but it is not. It needs one final approval. The critical approval is before the City Council. Remember, it doesn't go to the voters, even though it's a bond issuance, but it needs the approval of the City Council. The head of the Economic and Taxation Committee of the City Council, Carl Stokes, has been critical of this TIF. He was also critical of the Harbor Point TIF. Very few of his colleagues, many of whom we now know are lame ducks, share that enthusiasm. They're not going to be around. In fact, virtually anyone is going to be around for when this project actually, you know, comes to some fruition. So there is not yet scheduled a City Council hearing, and that will be coming up probably in the next week or so.
Yeah. June, July is when he said it was going to come up.
Right. Now, it is the Rawlins-Blake administration, which will be ending in December, wants to get this done under its watch. Planck has put a lot of pressure on the city in this very interesting argument. He says that you have to approve the entire TIF, even though many elements of this $535 million would not even go into place for another 10 or 12 years, in order for him to apply for state and federal funding for still more money for this project. At the same time, the BDC, which in advisory capacity has already approved the project in what were these secret meetings or closed meetings, says, well, we only approve this project if there's state and federal funding. So there's a little bit of a house of cards. The public, you know, has been confused. There's been a huge ad campaign by Sagamore Development to say that this is a wonderful project. You know, I love economic development in Baltimore. I'd love Under Armour to locate a factory in Baltimore, which it does not plan to do at all.
Right.
So look for the City Council, and it is not yet a done deal.
So, Mark Reuter, I hope you can come back and join us next week. We want to continue this after we see what you've put out in the Baltimore Brewers today. We're going to stay on this. I think the issues we've just learned here in this half an hour are critical, and also the things we learned about CSX and more that we really have to probe and push about how we want to develop the city and what it means to create jobs for people within the city and how we spend our tax money. Mark Reuter, thanks so much for the work you do. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Senior editor and reporter for the Baltimore Brew, and who you're hearing under me is the legendary Winfield Parker. Stay with us. He's coming up next.
Won't somebody